professional alcoholic.
The second one, the only time I ever went to one of these guys was I was getting a divorce. And the third one, the third profession, was the one where the guy said, put him in jail for 90 days. That'll cool him off, you know. So really, there's not a lot of things I like about Ray. But I'll tell you one thing, he's a hell of a fine person. And he tells a wonderful story. And those people that have heard it, don't nudge it and your next door partner and tell him, well, this is good. Just let them find out for themselves. So with no further fiddling around, let's call on Ray O.K.
My name is Ray O'Keefe, and I'm an alcoholic. I've never been introduced by a wetback before. I am a member of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group, located at Mamaroneck, New York. You've heard of that group, no doubt. I bring you greetings from the world-famous Mamaroneck Group. I'm authorized by our steering committee to wish you a very successful Summerfest 1981. And the vote of our committee was 11 to 7. It's good to be back in Oregon again. I haven't had any fresh air since I left. And it's good to meet some of the people I've met before on my trips out to the West. And I was very surprised. I really was amazed. There were so many Al-Anon ladies here, all those butterflies around, and Winnie's in charge of them all. The reason I was so surprised to see Winnie and all them butterflies around here is that I understand they're having a very, very large and important meeting of Al-Anon in Portland last night. And was being held in the mother church of all Al-Anon, the Church of Our Lady of Perpetual Revenge. I want to tell you about my drinking. I don't want you to miss any of this. This is a thrill a minute, this is. I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in New York City, and my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now, you won't know about that here in the West, but they drank in that neighborhood. You would actually see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. Hard to believe, huh? If you looked in my house, you'd see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. And when the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of the children. My brother Billy, on the other hand, was a very bad drunk, and in a neighborhood of Irish drunks, Billy O'Keefe stood out as a drunk. So when I showed up at the local place and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon, no one paid any attention to me. It was just another one of the O'Keefes coming by. I don't truly recall what it was they served me that day. It probably was a beer. That was a neighborhood drink. But whatever it was, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. And I liked the way it smelled. And I liked the way it tasted. And I liked what it did for my head. And I liked the noise and the smoke and the confusion. I liked the fist fights and the Irish music. I liked the bullshit. That's what I really liked. Like Terry, I was going through the parochial school system in a manner of speaking. And I got into all of the difficulties and troubles that you might imagine a young man would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held a neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously set by my brother Billy. When I was finished with high school, or more properly, when they were finished with me, because someone made a mistake in a small school up in New England, I got a chance to leave the neighborhood and I went to college. And when I got up there, my drinking changed. In the neighborhood, we drank beers and shots and beers. We call those bats and balls. But when we got north, they weren't drinking that way. There were no bars in that state, just restaurants. And they sat around the tables, and they drank beer out of bottles, and they sang college songs, and they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned the words of a couple of those songs. I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over. It was relatively safe, and things were slow on the campus. So one day I got a haircut and joined the Navy. And I ended up on a minesweeper in San Francisco. And I hate to be indelicate before such a large group of people, but I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier, and the new man slept on top. Don't get ahead of me, please, you know. It's not easy here. So I came back from my first liberty in San Francisco with all the beer that I could drink, and I had one of those kidney attacks that night. And I met the fellow who slept below me. I suppose he thought he'd be wet sometime in his naval career. It just hadn't occurred to him what happened while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. One day, this mighty ship of the line was floating around in the South Pacific, trying to stay out of harm's way. We were delivering the mail, is what we were doing, bringing the mail to our fighting men, who were then defending and protecting New Zealand. And giving their lives and shedding their blood so that ungrateful aliens could come here. I forgot to mention apple pie, am I? The executive officer of this ship sent for me, and he told me something I was to hear many, many times in my life. It never helped me with alcohol. In fact, if anything, it hurt. He said, "You are a very, very smart kid, O'Keefe." And I agreed with him right away. I thought he was beginning to show good judgment. He told me if I would pass some examinations they were giving, I would be qualified to go to the United States Naval Academy. So I took a series of exams, and I ended up in a very fancy preparatory school in Maryland with an appointment to the United States Naval Academy from the fleet. And I was in that school about 3 months when that executive officer sent for me. Apparently his experience was a little different than the other man's, because he threw me out of the school. He told me there were rules about people like me who went out through the windows and got drunk and came back and started riots. And he suggested that I resign my appointment and return to the fleet. In fact, he put his suggestion into the form of a written order. Well, like any well-trained military type, I got ready to be sent far, far away. But with characteristic military efficiency, I was placed on board the yacht of the President of the United States. I would like to amuse you with tales of intimacy with the President and my participation in affairs of state. Unfortunately, I have no such report to make. It was still the Navy. I got paid, then I got drunk, and then I waited to get paid, and then I got paid, and then I got drunk, and then I waited to get paid. And that's how I spent the balance of my enlistment. And when that was finished, I came back home to the neighborhood, undecorated, unhonored, unloved. Everything in the neighborhood was under control. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy, having invited a citizen of the Puerto Rican ancestry off of fire, the citizen bounced and lived to identify the Irish cop. My brother Billy came west and went into a more peaceful line of work. He went back in the United States Marine Corps. The 5220 Club was available for heroes. I qualified for a few checks. I gravitated to the local joints. I took up the game of shuffleboard. And I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions when I had one of those clear thoughts that flow in from time to time. I recalled that I'd been to college. So I got on a bus and I went back up there. And I arrived in the middle of a blizzard, and I walked into this place, and there they were, sitting around the table, drinking beer out of a bottle, singing no songs, wearing no shoes. So I got another pair of shoes. And by now, a grateful government was sending a check every month, so I was moderately solvent and therefore moderately drunk all the time. I was staying around the campus one day in my usual shape, and I saw a list of names on a bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate. And my name was on that list, and that was very good news. I thought I had another year to go. So I called up the widow, and I announced this event, and she came north, and that was a rather tender sight. The widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elm. About 10 years later, I was serving as a trustee of that college, and I'd go to meetings. They were still talking about my mother. It's not often in the state of Vermont where they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. When I came back to the neighborhood, the question was what to do, and my uncles, who ran the family, had voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman, because that's what my father had been, and that's what my mother had been. That's what my brother had been. That's what all my uncles and cousins were, except for the two morons that worked for the phone company. But I told them I wasn't going to do that. I told them I was going to do what I wanted to do. I always did what I wanted to do. That's part of being an alcoholic. And I told them I'd received a scholarship to law school, and I'd be unemployed for the next several years. And that was received with mixed emotions. But that's what happened. I went to law school. I had not seen a lawyer. I never met a lawyer before I went to law school. We didn't have lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We really didn't need any lawyers. I hate to be disloyal to the profession that's done so well for me, but I have to tell you, when I got to law school, I found I was in the company of the biggest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. These guys were very deadly. They all wore a suit with a vest, and they all wore eyeglasses. So as soon as I could get into uniform and get a pair of glasses I really didn't need, I looked around for a companion, someone to drink with. My mother always told me, play with nice boys your own age. But nobody drank in that crowd. They were all studying. They were all grinding away. So I became the biggest grind they ever had there. And I didn't drink at all in my first year, and very rarely in the next 2 years. With the result that when I came out of school, I had done well, and I was taken into a large, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. And it wasn't a total waste, because they taught me to say, oh, really, instead of no shit. Bad bunch. My superiors there determined that I ought to be trained as a trial lawyer, and so they sent me up to the courthouse in New York City to learn my trade. And I wasn't in the courthouse very long when I discovered that all the wise guys were across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon, and I learned to drink in a different, a more civilized, more genteel fashion. Very few members of the profession were knocking down bats and balls where anybody could see them. I discovered scotch in a tall glass with water and ice, and you sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the rituals that surround the very, very dry martini. And to this day, to this minute, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to those things, and they almost destroyed me. Well, after about a year of this civilizing influence, it was necessary in my natural development that I be married. And I had located a lady, or she had located me. I'm not sure how these things work. I was working in a hotel. I was a bellhop, and Mrs. O'Keefe was a guest. And that pretty well characterizes the relationship right now.
Well,
About 2 years after that, I received a phone call from the law school that I had attended from the dean, and I was invited to go see the dean. And he appointed me to the faculty, and I became Professor O'Keefe. And I responded with great alacrity to being a professor, and I was very nervous about that type of position. And so I knew I drank a great deal, and I decided that I would enter into controlled drinking. I decided I would cut back on my drinking because of this job that made me nervous. And I entered into this phase of controlled drinking. I was 26 years old at that time, and I felt that I had to do something about it, so I tried to cut back, but I was very unsuccessful at that. I couldn't do it. But I tried for several years, but as the time went on, I became a little more secure about the teaching, so I went back out to drink the way I liked to drink. In fact, it was the only way I knew how to drink. My father died when I was 2, and my older brother, Billy, was my hero, and Billy taught me all of the good things of life, including how to drink. I drank like Billy. I drank until I fell down, or the cops arrived, or the place went on fire. Something had to happen. I used to see people leaving, and I would wonder where they were going. But the whiskey was right here, and they were going there. And in this period of time, too, I rolled around the city of New York, and I did a lot of things that aren't important. I bounced around and did all kinds of things. I even ran for office one time and lost. In this period of time, too, we bought a large, semi-authentic colonial home in a village called Larchmont, New York, a village which abounds in semi-authentic colonial homes. And we had it up to 5 or 6 children, and the usual number of motor vehicles, and the usual memberships in the usual clubs, and I was teaching and working and politicking and drinking. And had you asked me at that time, at age 34, how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. In fact, I would have told you I was doing very well, whether you asked me or not. That was one of my favorite themes. Truth of the matter was, at this time, I had become a terrific daily drunk. And my day would have killed an ordinary man. I used to come to in the morning in that wet bed because the problem with the kidneys had continued unabated all those years. And I would struggle out of my damp sack and I'd begin my morning calisthenics. My calisthenics were performed kneeling on the floor of a bathroom with my head in a bowl. And I would have all the water running, the water in a sink and the water in a tub and the water in a shower. Because I did not want Ms. O'Keefe and all of those little O'Keefes to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. And I would come downstairs in my sincere blue suit with a vest, carrying over my shoulder, much like Santa Claus, a sack of wet laundry. Because Ms. O'Keefe told me that the diaper service was for the children. And she did not think that a lady of her extreme breeding ought to do the wash of a 34-year-old bedwetter. Can you imagine a man of my stature in a community starting off each morning with a load of wash? But once I got my wash out of the way, help was at hand. I used to keep a quart of vodka in the refrigerator. My children call that daddy's juice. And I'd take a few bangs on daddy's juice, and then I'd take a chance as to whether I would throw up in front of all those people. I knew if I lit up a cigarette, it was all over. Sooner or later, I'd get on a train, and I'd go to New York City where I worked, and the train would go to Grand Central. If you know anything about Grand Central in New York City, it is not simply a railroad terminal. Grand Central is a collection of saloons that are connected by tunnels. And I'd zoom around the tunnels and pop up in here like a mole here or there. And I would do a repair job, and then I'd head for the school, and as soon as I got up to that imposing institution up at Lincoln Center, I would run in the front door, and my first thought was, how do I get out of here? And I'd run out again. And I go across town to a law firm where I would steal. Every morning I would steal $20 from the petty cash. And There's nothing like giving money to a drunk. It's like whole blood. And I'd run out in the middle of Park Avenue with my $20, and I'd jump into a cab, and he would take me down to where I really belong, my first parish, the bar room down by the courthouse. And by this time, the other lawyers were treating me like a playmate or a mascot or something. And I'd run in, and I'd throw out my dough, and I'd buy a drink, and they'd buy a drink, and a bartender would buy a drink, and we'd have a good time, and maybe we'd have lunch, and maybe we wouldn't, and maybe we'd talk some business, and maybe we wouldn't, and maybe we'd settle a case, and maybe we wouldn't. But the big thing was, about every 20 minutes, there'd be a drink in my hand. And I had to figure it out in some peculiar alcoholic fashion that I was particularly brilliant at 2 o'clock. So I'd schedule classes for 2, and I'd zoom up to the school and inflict myself on those poor, unsuspecting sophisticates who had come to study law at my feet. And I would shortchange the kids, and I'd be out of there, and I'd be into a cab, and I'd go over to Grand Central to commute. Now, even though I grew up in the city, I understood the theory of commuting. Commuters are entitled to a drink before they get on the train. So I'd have 10 or 12. And I would take a train going north. It didn't have to go to Larchmont. North was good enough for me. And I got to see a great deal more of Bridgeport, Connecticut than any civilized man would have to. Sooner or later, I'd arrive home and bounce off a few walls and take what was left of Daddy's juice out of the refrigerator and fill up an old cheese glass like Mary and inquire if anybody wanted a martini. But I was the only one that drank in that house in those days. So I'd have a few pops, and I would eat or not eat, depending on my mood. Evenings I would spend in civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car or puking on some hostess's sofa or playing a little grab ass with the ladies of Larchmont and a sorrier looking crop you have never seen. Most evenings, I would just stay home and vegetate, and I would watch television with one eye like this, trying to get those sets together. And I would drink, and I'd watch the television with one eye, and I'd go through the programming and through the news and through the late show and all the rest of it. And finally, my big moment would come when they played the Star Spangled Banner. And the Marines would go up Mount Suribachi. And the planes would fly by. And the destroyers would come through the water. And they would play that song. And I would cry. Oh. I would weep and sob and cry. And then I'd go upstairs and wet the bed. That's it. Can I get some more of that? Now, this is not once in a while. This is every day. Weekends, I would say, for binges. And if everybody around me would mind their own business, I could get drunk 3 times on Saturday and 3 times on Sunday. Well, as anybody who's ever been married can tell you, while all of this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way that I drank. And I would pay no attention to her. Why should I? First of all, she's a wife and they don't count. And secondly, she's not an attorney, and I would tell her that. And then we would have the discussion. And I would say, you have this wrong. You're wrong. Again, you're wrong. I don't drink that much, I would say. I really, after all, I'd say, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much. And I'd be out the door, you know. Can't insult my mommy. I'm leaving. So this drove her crazy, and she betook herself to a physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. And he couldn't figure anything the matter with her until she told him that she lived with a drunk. And that explained many things to him, and he sent her to me with this message. And there was this house. It was a very nice house that we lived in. We don't live there. We moved from that house. We had some more children, and we moved. We childrened ourselves out of that house. That's a polite expression of how we came to move. I'm not going too fast for you, am I? No. But in this house, we had a room. It was very nice. It was a den, and it was a very lovely room, and it had a fireplace, and it was panels, all the rest of it. And I had erected on the wall of that room a shrine. Not a shrine, was not any saint that you ever heard of. This shrine was to me. And there were pictures of O'Keefe with the great and the near great, and there were proclamations and diplomas and plaques, and there were mementos of political campaigns, and there were letters, you know, Dear Ray, best regards, Jack, that kind of stuff. And I would sit there one eye and drink, and they put on a commercial, and I'd look up at the wall, and I'd say, you are some piece of work, and I'd have another drink. So Mrs. O'Keefe came to pay a visit to the shrine this day. And before she lit the candle, she delivered this message that she had gotten from her doctor, the obstetrician. He told her that her husband, the professor, was an alcoholic. Oh, those were fighting words. I rose to defend myself, as was my custom, and I started, and the first point I made was valid. I took a very strong position against a physician who would diagnose a patient without having seen him. I was against that shabby medical practice. Then I went into high gear, and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. And at this point, the conversation was coming downhill at a terrible rate. And then it happened. I don't know how this happened. I can't explain how this happened. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk that I am giving. But I cannot explain what happened. In the middle of all this yelling and screaming, I suddenly stopped, and I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe for the first time, I admitted to anyone, that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. Because 3 days later, I found myself a prisoner in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I'd only been there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was passing by. In addition to these outrageous circumstances in which I, an innocent person, found myself, it also happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I pointed this out to this man in a white coat, and I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day I had attained age 35. And therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. Washington and Jefferson. This wasn't Serenity Lane. This was a very fancy rattlebox. And then he went away and he left me. And so for the next week or so, I did all of those warm and wonderful, happy, pleasant, and interesting things that alcoholics do when they withdraw from alcohol. I shook. I sweat. I did everything terrific that you can think about. And I finally came up for air. And I was visited by the staff of the hospital. And they, of course, were psychiatrists. And the first one fixed his cool, professional glance upon me. And he asked me that question that so many people insist on asking alcoholics. It's such a brilliant line of inquiry. He said, "Tell me, Professor, why do you drink so much?" So I told him. I told him of my wealthy parents. I told him that Momsy and Dada used to travel a lot. And they had left me in the hands of cruel servants who were black. And I had become insecure and turned toward drinking. And he was very sympathetic. And he went away, and about an hour later, one of his colleagues came in, and he asked me the same question. So I told him, after all, one doesn't lie to a professional. I told him of my impoverished youth. I told him of the beatings I'd received at the hands of my drunken mother. I even told him about the time my sister Marie stole my rubber duck when I was 3 years of age. He told me I had come to the right place. Said help was at hand. Said with his help and with the help of medical science, one day I would drink safely again. And I said, "Thank you, doctor." He was my kind of a doctor, that doctor. And the last psychiatrist in to see me, and the last psychiatrist I have ever seen, except for the one I used to drive to meetings from time to time, who managed to drink himself to death last year. This last guy came in, had a pronounced Middle European accent, and he was fascinated by two things. One was my professorial status, and the other was the fact that I was wearing sneakers in January. Now, we had a very long and involved chat around the footwear. He found some mysterious relevance to the shoes that had escaped me completely until he brought the subject up. So I engaged him in badinage about it for 2 hours, and finally he popped the question, and I gave him a sexual aberration that drove him right out of the room. Well, I wasn't as smart as I want everybody to think, because they had a conference about the fat guy in room 102 or something, and they came to the conclusion that there was a fraud in their hospital. And so I was informed the next day that I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution. I told him I've been thrown out of better places than this. So I went back up to my room, and I was undergoing therapy. My therapy was I was playing Monopoly with three guys who were there. They weren't there for alcoholism. They were just there. And we were playing Monopoly. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. If you know anything about the game of Monopoly, and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do pretty well. I had the boardwalk, I had a couple of hotels. You know, I was very happy into the Monopoly marathon. And a couple of days later, a message came, and it was that I had a visitor, and I was sent into my room, and I waited, and I didn't know who would be coming to see me. And through the door of this room came this big, imposing-looking guy. And he said that he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and at the hospital had asked him to speak to me about our program. And I reverted right to type. I almost had him by the throat. I said, "Alcoholics Anonymous." And he told me to shut up. I immediately forgave him. I knew that he had not been properly instructed. I knew that they had forgotten to tell him who I was. So I continued to speak. And he told me to sit down and to shut up and to listen to him. Well, he was an imposing-looking guy. And I was not a well person. So for the first time in 35 years, I sat and I began to hear. And he explained to me, as I have been trying to indicate to you, and as we are instructed in our book, what his life had been like, how he had come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what life had been for him since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to meetings. And I said, do you mean outside to meetings? He said, outside. I said, I'll go. Besides that, he gave me matches. Nobody else had allowed me to have any matches. So that's how it began for me. And that was in January of 1963. And that's how it began. He began taking me around. We went out every night, and he made arrangements for me to go locally, and I came out about a month later, and I began to go locally, and I don't recall so much of all of that. I was too new and too nervous and too afraid and too everything. And of course, this very fancy raffle box had turned me loose with a large jar of those pills that they insisted on giving alcoholics, and I walked around and my head buzzed a lot. But I know myself fairly well. I figured I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president if I joined something. I would serve a term as your president. You would give me a plaque. I would put it on the wall of the shrine, and that's it. Onward and upward. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. And it should come as no surprise to you, although it was a terrible blow to me, to find that some 10 months later, I was very, very drunk. And this time, of course, I was drunk with a great difference, because I had turned away from the great power that is in our program. And I was to stay drunk for a period of time. And I won't bring you through that because it's too long, and it really still shakes me very much when I go through it. Just let me indicate to you that it was, without question, the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I entered into that half world where the days are very long and the nights are very dark. And I would drink a week, and then I wouldn't drink a month. Or I would drink a month, and then I wouldn't drink a week. And I would drink and sometimes go to the meetings. Or I'd go to the meetings, and then I would drink. And things began to happen to me in this period of time that had never happened to me before. And I do not speak to you now of things that happened to me in this period of time that I no longer consider to be significant. I do not speak to you now of the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty and fired as a tenured professor of law. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was in serious, and I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I had lost the affection of all those who were around me. All of these things happened to me in this period of time, but that is not what I am speaking to you about. What I now speak to you about is that there was, in my case, and perhaps in yours, a terrible, terrible wasting of my spirit. My spirit, that thing that separates me from my cat and separates me even from each of you. That spirit which gives to this individual form Whatever individuality or personality or character that it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was practically extinguished, and I knew it, and there was nothing that I could do about it. I'd been here, and this didn't work for me. And by this time, I'd been everywhere else. I'd been through the hospitals and the drying out places and the sanitariums, and I'd been through the jobs and the friends and the money, and I'd been through the politicians and the bosses and the clubhouses. I knew that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are simply not permitted to go. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we are simply not permitted to sink. And it seems to me that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. Now, I don't know where this line is for you. I only know what happened to me. And this is a personal, and it is an individual thing. And it differs in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. I received a phone call from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis, and the man told me that my brother had died in that hospital of alcoholism, and that he had been brought to the Veterans Hospital from the Skid Row of Minneapolis. And so Billy O'Keefe died alone, without friends, without family, a long way from the neighborhood. But my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's how he stopped. And for other people, it can be something fairly trivial. But the line is there somewhere. And we all come to it in our own time and in our own way. But come to it, we must. And I arrived at a day that really wasn't so different from any other day. I was 3 or 4 days away from a drink. I was in what then passed for my office, and I was nervous and upset and thirsty. And I thought I would go get a drink. I knew that would help for an hour or so. But instead of that, I was given this great gift of being able to call a longtime friend of mine who is a longtime member of our program. And he is my sponsor, and his name is John. And I called John and told him what I was up to, and he said, "I'll be right over." And of course, he came over. And John walked into that room, and he looked so good, and I felt so bad. And I asked him what I would have to do to be as successful as he had been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And John fixed me with that look that he has. And he said, "Don't drink. You go to the meetings. You'll be all right." I didn't want him to tell me that. And I told him I didn't want him to tell me that. I began to explain things to John. I said, "John, what you really don't understand is the real problem is this place where I work. I shouldn't be here, man, a lawyer like me. I shouldn't be in a place like distrust for the money, John." "Yeah," he said, "well, don't drink. You go to meetings, that'll work right out." I sensed that there was no dialogue there. And so did John, because he said, He made a couple of phone calls, and he said, come on, you know, you're not working. You're not doing anything here. Let's go. So he took me over to Grand Central, and he stuck me on a train going up to Lachmann. It's about a 40-minute ride. About halfway up, I reconsidered. You understand. I gave it some thought. You know, what the hell did I call him for? You know, I must have panicked. Don't drink, right? Don't drink. That's what he said. Don't drink, huh? Don't drink my ass. Wait till this train stops. And that was my attitude. And when I got off the train at Lachmann, standing on the platform of the Lachmann station was my mailman, a guy named Al, who was then chairman of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group. And Al said, get in the car. I said, get out of here, Al. I don't hang around with mailmen. Al said, some guy named John called me about you from New York. Get in the car. Well, a man in my position and stature cannot have a fist fight with a mailman or anybody else for that matter. So I got in Al's car. I said, Al, I got a lot of problems, Al. And Al said, yeah, well, don't drink. You got a meeting. And if any of you are foolish enough to ask my advice because I'm from out of town, that's it. Don't drink. Go to meetings. She'll be all right. Al drove me around and came back that night and took me up to the world's greatest AA group. And I didn't drink that day. And I haven't had a drink since. But first, I had that day. And I had that day because two members of this fellowship were so filled with the gratitude of this fellowship that they took what God sent that day. A drunken, arrogant, dishonest man. And because they were so grateful for what they had received, they gave me the day. And I hope, I truly hope it is that same sense of gratitude that allows me to be with you this morning. Because like Al and like John, and like every sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a great debt to pay. And this is one of the ways that I do that. And then the days began to pile up, and I would see John every day, and I'd see Al every night, and I'd get my instructions. And after I had 3 or 4 months or so, one day, John said to me, he said, you know, Raymond, you're a nice guy, and you hang around pretty good, and you don't drink, and you're going to the meetings. He said, you know, there's a great deal more to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous besides not drinking. He says, it's time for you to learn something of the program. He says, it's time for you to read the book. And because I'm the way I am, I said, what are you talking about? Read the book. Rarely have we seen anyone fail who has thoroughly followed. And John gave me that look. You know that look? The look that long-term members of AA reserve for smart-ass people. John kept staring at me, and he said, read it again. And I said, yes, John, because by that time my sponsor had taken me to the point where I hope your sponsor has taken you, where no matter what he said, ultimately I would say, yes, John. So I began to read again the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was appalled, really appalled at my initial ignorance. I had no idea when first I read the book that it had been written some 5 years after the meeting of Bill and Bob. And that during that period of time, 100 or so men and women had become sober. I did not know or appreciate that the book was nothing more or less than a chronicle of the early members. I did not know or appreciate that the steps that are contained in the 5th chapter of that book are steps literally taken by these men and these women as they became sober. I thought when first I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I said to you that my name was Ray O'Keefe and that I was an alcoholic, I was doing something about the first step of this program. Of course, that's my name, and I'm an alcoholic. But the men and women who founded our program did a great deal more than simply identify themselves as alcoholics. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives had become unmanageable. Their lives had become unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. It was all the same thing with them. They were powerless. They were without power. They had no power. It says in our book that the dilemma of the alcoholic is his lack of power. He has no power. He is powerless. But they didn't drink. And time began to pass for them. And time has passed for me. And for all the people in this room, as we demonstrated this morning. And for those of you who are new, time will pass for you. And time has a wonderful way of passing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. And somewhere after this succession of days, these men and these women came to believe that there was a power greater than their own. And they believed that this power could restore them to sanity. And this was not just a casual observation that they made, or an offhand reference that they shared. They believed this. This was part of them. It was vital to them, this belief that they believed that there was a power greater than their own, and that that power could restore them to sanity. And so firm and so true and so real was that belief that they were able to make a decision to turn over their will and their lives to the care of this power that they had come to believe in, this God, as they each understood him. And they were very, very bright. Because at a time in the history of this country when no one else had this notion, they conceived alcoholism to be a disease. They conceived it to be a disease that was physical and mental and spiritual. A disease of the body and of the mind and of the spirit. And when they stopped drinking, they found that their bodies responded quickly. And when they came to believe that they could be restored to sanity, they began to enjoy a mental recovery. It was slower than the physical recovery, but it was perceptible. They could notice it. And when they made that decision, the decision to turn over their life wasn't so much. They had already admitted that their lives were unmanageable. But the decision to turn over the will, that was the thing. The alcoholic will, that was the thing that had me in all of that trouble for all of those years, and I never knew it. I was exactly what the book describes, an extreme example of self-will run riot. When they were able to make that decision, when they were able to offer themselves to God as they understood God, when they asked to be relieved of the bondage of self, that they might better do his will. When they asked that their difficulties be removed from them, so that it would give evidence to those they would help of his love and his power and his way of life. When they truly surrendered, when they let go and they let God, they began not only to enjoy a spiritual recovery, but they lay down the basis of a spiritual way of life to which you and I are heir. They left that to us. And they were very smart because they understood that it was not enough to simply stop drinking and start praying. A lot of people have tried that. It doesn't work. They knew that if they were to be successful, if they were to be sober, somehow they would have to change. And in order to accomplish this change in themselves,
they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory of themselves. They could be searching because by now they were relatively clear. They could be fearless because they had made a decision to turn over their life to the care of this God of their understanding. Imagine an alcoholic without fear. That's impossible. It embarrasses me to tell you that the ruling emotion of my life when I drank was fear. For all of those years, the great man and the boy professor was afraid most of the time. And this program helps with that. And when they were finished with that inventory, so great was the love and the affection of these men and women, one for the other, that they were able to readmit their inventory to themselves, to this God of their understanding, and to someone else. It was a great relief for me to be able to go to my sponsor, John, and bring him my inventory. Because I was the kind of person who spent a lot of time at the bar making sure that everybody knew who I was. And I spent a lot of time making sure that nobody knew what I was. And it was a great relief for me to be able to go to John and tell him, here I am, and this is what I'm all about. And it was he who made the exact nature of my wrongs, because I really wasn't clear enough to see it. And then they developed an attitude which was difficult for me. They became entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And with compelling logic, they went to this great power that they had come to believe in, and they humbly asked him to remove their shortcomings. And they asked him to take all of it, the good and the bad, so that we could better serve and to be useful to those about us. It was not just an empty prayer. The point of removing our character defects is that we be useful to those about us, and that's what the prayer is about in the book. And then they wrote a list, because they knew, as I knew, that they had not come here alone. They knew that in their lives, as in mine, there was a certain wreckage. And so they wrote a list of everyone they had ever harmed. And they became willing to make amends to everyone on the list. And they didn't just talk about it, they went out and they did it. And you may recall, our literature describes Dr. Bob's first day when he stopped drinking. He got back home late that night and Bill asked him where he'd been. And he said he had been driving around Akron, Ohio, in his old Buick, mending fences. It's an old Vermont expression. He had been making amends the very first day that he began to stop drinking. And I don't think that we need wait too long in our program to do everything that is expected of us. And great things began to come into the lives of these men and women. Great things happened to them. And some of the things that happened to them as a result of making their amends and complying and putting into their lives the first nine steps of this program are reflected in our book. And I have a little portion of the big book here, and I've left a whole stack of them over here for you, with compliments of the world's greatest AA group. And this is what happened to these people at this stage of their recovery, and I think it's so wonderful. It says, I can't read that because of my eyes, but I can read this. 82. It says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door upon it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us all of those things that we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And I'm very happy and proud to report to you that each and every one of those promises has come into my life, wholly, solely, and simply because I am a member of this fellowship. And at this point, these were sober people, and the book said that they had been at that point restored to sanity. And so they knew that something that had been given to them was very, very precious. And they knew that in order to enjoy this thing that was so very precious that had been given to them, they would have to maintain it. And so they continued to take personal inventory. They concerned themselves with themselves. They took a personal inventory. They did not take other people's inventory. And they knew they could not enjoy the luxury of a resentment. They knew they could not be resentful or hateful. They knew if they were resentful, they would drink. And if they drank, they would die. It was simple with them. And so when they were wrong, they promptly admitted that they were wrong. And so true and so real was their reliance upon this power greater than their own, this God of their understanding, that they sought to improve their conscious contact with God. And they did that by prayer and by meditation. They meditated. They gave thought to their condition. They considered who they were and what they were. And they engaged in a very fine, a very excellent form of meditation. It is a form of meditation in which you are now engaged. They listened. They listened. On the odd chance that this power that they believed in would speak to them. And this power that they believed in did speak to them in their groups, at their meetings. And then they prayed, brother. They prayed. Nobody needs a sermon from me on the value of prayer. When they prayed only for knowledge of God's will for them and the power to carry it out. And they got great benefits from prayer. I don't know, of course, however it was with you, but it always seemed to me, as I was growing up and coming along, I always felt as though I really didn't belong. As Mary explained last night, I had that feeling that I didn't belong. I knew I was in the wrong family. I knew I was in the wrong neighborhood. I didn't belong with those people. I should not have been in that school. I didn't like that school. I couldn't get along, and I went along like that. And that was my whole life. And even though the outside fit in so well, I was a prize student. I was successful with my friends. I was always present in my classes. I got along great. I had a great legal career. I peaked early, and I was hanging around with the President of the United States. I was doing all of these things, but I didn't belong. And somewhere in that region that Mary describes, the wind blew. Something was howling. And it tells us in the 12 and 12, on the chapter on prayer, that as a result of prayer, a great sense of belonging comes to us. We are no longer lost or alone or frightened or purposeless. That despite all of the evidence in the hostile world that surrounds us, we understand that the principal values of life are truth and justice and love. And we understand that a loving God watches over us, and that when we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And that's pretty close to the words of the 12 and 12. And I'm very happy to report to you that as a result of prayer, I have achieved that great sense of belonging. And when I tell you that my name is Ray O'Keefe and I am an alcoholic and I am a member of the world famous Mamaroneck group, I'm really telling you who I am and what I am and where I belong. Because I'm not just a member of the group, I belong to that group. A little later on in their development, they came upon a prayer, and they appropriated that prayer, and they thought it would help them. And this time they prayed for themselves. And the only thing they asked was peace of mind. And so they asked God to grant them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. And they did change. Something happened to them. Something happened to those men and women. There was a great change in their life. There was a great substitution of their standards. There was a great conversion of their values. And this difference in these men and women, the difference between being drunk and being sober, this great difference they termed a spiritual awakening. And they had this spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And these were the men and the women who at the beginning of this process had admitted that they were hopeless and helpless and powerless. These were the ones who had no power. But having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, they found that they held in their hands and in their hearts and in our program one of the greatest sources of spiritual power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. They actually had the power to save life. And the only thing they were using was that great power of example of one drunk or another. And armed with that power, and having had that kind of a spiritual awakening, they began to carry the message to the alcoholic. And they did that so well that you and I have come together on a morning in July of 1981 in the Willamette Valley of the great state of Oregon. And that, my dear, dear brothers, is a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And they knew, just as my sponsor knows, and Bob and Neil and all of my friends here know, that there is so much more to our program besides a simple device to keep me from drinking like a pig. They knew that what had been given to them was an entirely new way of living. And in order to enjoy that new way of life, they resolved that they would practice principles in all their affairs. And so where they had been, as I always was, very dishonest, they tried the honest. Where they had been, as always was my custom, arrogant, they tried not to be sad. Happily for me, and perhaps for us all, they said that we are not saints, that this is not a program of spiritual perfection. It is a program of spiritual progress, and my sponsor has instructed me, and so I can believe that I can progress in this program if I don't drink and I go to the meetings. I could keep you for many, many more minutes and tell you of all of the great and wonderful things that have come into my life, simply and solely and wholly because I am a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I will not catalog for you all of the material benefits and all of the professional successes and honors that have been given me. I will simply state to you that every single thing I lost in alcoholism has been given back to me two or three times over, simply because I am a member of the group in Lemurg. I can report to you that, as your chairman indicated, that I had served two terms as judge in my area. I have been for the last several years reappointed as a professor of law. But the thing that will express what I am saying most, and a thing that I think you will find worthwhile, is that I bring you the happy and fraternal greetings of five of my children who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if it's a record, but we're trying. There's a couple of more qualifying. And so you can see that everything that should be happening to me is happening to me. And it's only because of this program, and I never delude myself that there is any other reason for the way that I am able to live. I, of course, would be very remiss if I did not express my appreciation to whoever it was in the committee that had the very good judgment to bring me to Oregon. I truly enjoy the weekend. I find your conference, what I've been able to see and observe of it, has a certain spirit and a certain pizzazz and just great or good or better than practically any place I've ever been. It gives me the great opportunity to be here and to be able to visit not only with you, but to visit with the country around here and to be able to meet with and to enjoy your country and to be with the other half of my heart. I am one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who are privileged to travel a great deal. And everywhere I go, I say just about the same thing, and I cannot apologize for that. And every time I end, as I now end, I end the same way. And I bring you and remind you of a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous called A Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is, I think, our best piece of literature. And in that pamphlet at the end, the author takes a biblical turn. And he reminds us of the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And so these two men found the Lord, and they walked with him a while. And they stopped him, and they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we have been waiting for? Or should we wait for another?" And the Lord really didn't answer that question. But he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the lame walk and the blind see, that the deaf hear and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And we all know that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear friends, here in Oregon, in happy Summerfest assembled, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that observation, it seems to me that the blind do see and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear, and most certainly the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again, through the longest day and into the darkest night, the good news of our program carried to the alcoholic who still suffers, the poor in spirit. Thank you.